This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore a seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brian Hamilton of Deerfield Academy, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Simone Mueller. She is DFG Heisenberg Professor for Global Environmental History and Environmental Humanities at the University of Augsburg, Germany. She is the author of 2016's Wiring the World, the Social and Cultural Creation of Global Telegraph Networks. And she's here now to talk about her latest book. It's called The Toxic Ship, The Voyage of the Cayenne Sea and the Global Waste Trade. It comes out today from University of Washington Press. Dr. Mueller, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brian. Hello to everyone listening. I'm so excited to be talking to you about the toxic ship.
So, I mean, when I was a little environmentalist, solid waste was a very prominent environmental topic, both on the nightly news, but also on kids' shows about the environment. And in my adult life, it seems much diminished in sort of that mainstream coverage. Like everything, it's been eclipsed by climate, certainly. But I mean, we've had Yucca Mountain, and we've had the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and there's been, recently the fight against single-use plastic in the United States, at least in Europe. And maybe there's been some discussion of e-waste, kind of, if I don't know if that's really broken through in terms of like a household topic. But your book has certainly returned it, in my mind, to a place of prominence. And so I just wonder, what fascinates you about waste?
I have to say, I'm actually coming the other way around. So my journey is rather one from the telegraphs to the global waste economy. And so I have to start out with saying I wasn't always an environmental historian, but I was trained as a global historian, fascinated about globalization processes. And my first book, Wiring the World, was on the social and cultural creation of global telegraph networks. And that was just such a neat story, in a way, about globalization. You have all those primary sources that are heralding how submarine telegraphs are bringing about world peace, and all those scholars who kind of join in the chorus with, yes, world communication is for global markets. It's the opening of world politics, the global governance really is kind of bringing the world together. And I felt at the end of the book that, yes, there is some truth to this global connectivity and all the positive aspects to it. But I wasn't quite content with just that perspective. And so I started looking for what I call the dark side of power, kind of like the negative effects of a globalized world. And that's how I ended up musing about hazardous waste and the global waste economy. I felt like, okay, if you really want to dig into the dark side of power of globalization, there are actually like three aspects you could study: human trafficking, drugs and weapon trade, or the trade in hazardous waste. And I felt like the last one was probably the most approachable as a historian. And so that's how I ventured into studying the global waste economy.
And that's how you got to this ship here. And it's a great narrative device for telling a global story in a coherent way that also is immensely complex because you can follow the ship as often as you can. Sometimes the ship goes off you know, out of view, but let's begin at the beginning so we can understand how this works. Your story begins in Philadelphia, the home port for the Caen Sea and its voyage. Can you set the scene for us? You know, what do we need to know about this city? And you're very clear to say that it was Philadelphia, but it also could have been other cities in the United States and elsewhere. But what do we need to know about Philadelphia at this time to understand why it put 15,000 tons of ash on the ship in 1986?
Right. So the story of the Caen Sea starts in the streets of Philadelphia. And I think I just like the sound of that sentence. And it just comes neatly together. But essentially, it is a story that starts and ends in Philadelphia, but it's not per se about Philadelphia. And I think that's quite important to tease out. But it rather starts in a city, in a U.S. city in the 1980s that has been struggling immensely from like the financial downturn, from unemployment, and like all the downward spiraling effects that came with deindustrialization, and so we do have a city that, for instance, is struggling with like an immense loss of jobs because like industrial companies move out with. An immensely fundamental overhaul of like the ethnic setup of the city. I mean, 1980s Philadelphia, it becomes predominantly African American. It becomes predominantly with people with an immigrant status, with a non-white status. You have really like more and more pitting against each other of like Philadelphia city with like the counties around it that become predominantly white. And so there's like the affluent suburbs and the struggling city in the middle. And I feel like that's the composition that we have, not only in Philadelphia, but that we have in Pittsburgh, that we have in Detroit, or other like cities in the U.S. that are like centered around the Rust Belt or just going to struggling former industrial centers. And here that's where like in the midst of this struggle, in the midst of this economic and financial struggle, because if you have like the high wage earners move outside of the city, it also means you have less of a tax base for like which you need to pay for like city services. And that's how that story relates to waste, right? If you like don't have enough money to actually pay for the services. And so this like the story of the Caen Sea really starts with like an urban waste crisis in Philadelphia, with like the sanitary workers being on strike for 3 weeks straight. And it's like it's July 1986, it's humid, it's hot. So the whole city is like smelling of putrefying garbage. And that's like when you see two things at the same time. You see like how long the city's been expanding without really figuring out its waste disposal system, how it's like built on a broken waste disposal system, and that people are not willing to put up with the garbage in their midst. And so that's when like the decision in a city council is made to try something new, to really say, okay, we're shipping Philadelphia waste, not only to New Jersey or to the counties around it, which was kind of the go-to method beforehand, but we're shipping it abroad.
And before we talk about that global trade, could you also say a bit about just the ash itself and the composition of the ash? I was teaching an environmental studies course once, and I remember I had this 4 a.m. idea where I just brought in some sweepings from my floor and said, let's talk about this as a historical document. What can we tell about me or about the time we're living in from this literal dust? There was maybe some needles from a Christmas tree or that kind of thing, but also there was some stuff that was hadn't been produced 50 years earlier and things like that. So what if we were to look into the ash, what would we find there?
That's such a neat way. I think I might steal that idea for teaching.
Go for it. It was a little weird at first. You're like, here's some garbage from my house.
True, but my experience is like students usually like really jump at it. So the composition of the ash, that's kind of two things at the same time. There's kind of like a scientific answer that I can give to you, which is relatively short. So the scientific answer is it's incinerator ash. That means it's the end product that comes from incinerating Philadelphia household waste at the time. Like at the time, the city has two big incinerators that are really running over time to accommodate the rising levels of waste in the city. And so what you would find in it are just kind of the burnings of leftover food, paper, plastics. Let's say for like 1980s is the time where TV dinners are really, really big. So that would probably go in that. And so everything that people would throw away at home, that's what kind of goes into the incinerators, then it's burned. And kind of the end product of it is the ash. But the point, and that's kind of like the trouble in the 1980s, is that waste incineration can produce hazardous waste from normal solid household waste. And because like when you put together leaning something that's kind of like in wooden paper with plastics, that's when you create toxicants, dioxins. So when you burn household waste and you have components of lignin, which is like basically like in paper together with plastics, that's when like in the process of burning these two elements together, that's when you create dioxins and furans, which are highly toxic and carcinogenic elements. In addition to that, what also waste incineration does, it's shrinking the waste level and therefore concentrating, for instance, like heavy metals that are in it. So as much as we like waste incineration because it really reduces the amount of waste that we have, the process is difficult or questionable because at the end of it, it does produce something that's more toxic than what came in it, at least in the 1980s.
I think I always assumed that incineration, that there was a long period in which people did it ignorantly. We're like, oh, problem solved. It's out of here. And then there was a period after, you know, consciousness was raised by environmentalism or whatever, where people did it kind of shamefully. But there's this middle period here where you show the mayor and others sort of excited about, for instance, waste to energy as an alternative to recycling in the city, when both of those were live options. Why was that?
Absolutely, because in the 1980s, we are in this middle period with waste incinerators. It's like they're coming back to life. They seem the solution to the problem of rising waste levels, waste amounts that need to go somewhere. So you need to reduce the kind of the amount of it. And they also come in handy at a time when recycling really wasn't something that many kind of people, many mayors, many kind of people in the city governance were really too keen on because they felt it was not something that would work. So like in Philadelphia at the time, you had a battle going on between like the mayor, who was absolutely pro waste incineration and actually wanted to build another waste to energy incinerator. And interestingly, his city council, who like followed the lead from a couple of neighborhood initiatives, who did not want yet another waste incinerator in the city, but rather wanted to try like implementing a thorough recycling system. And it's also like a time, this is the battle between two political discussions in the city. And it's also the time when science in itself predominantly still presumes. So the majority position of scientists at the time, like 1986 to 1988, is that waste incineration actually is not harmful. that you can put the ash that comes from waste incineration, that you just can put it in landfills. There are a couple of like scientists who challenge that, who say like, no matter how high the temperature is, no matter how well you burn it, you still create dioxins and furans, you still create heavy metals, and you still create hazardous waste. But that wasn't followed. That wasn't followed in science, and most importantly, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, also didn't follow on that. And so this is what like made waste incineration actually like an attractive waste disposal method.
And what's unusual in this part of the story is that we have this waste is incinerated, but the ash doesn't go to a neighboring county, doesn't go to New Jersey as it might have in the past. It goes onto a ship. It goes onto the Caen Sea. But you note that this is actually, that Philadelphia wasn't necessarily a pioneer in this way, that there had already been at this time a new and flourishing international trade in waste. What did that trade look like, and why did it happen then?
The export of hazardous waste is actually directly correlated to the passage of stricter environmental regulation in the United States. And that all has to do with the Solid Waste Act and like a couple of amendments that 1976, so you have RCRA, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, passed. And it's really, really interesting to see how the moment RCRA is implemented in 1980, you have out of a sudden the rise in export notifications for hazardous waste. And that has to do with the fact that prior to RCRA, prior to the Resource Conservation Recovery Act in the United States, you had no legal definition of what hazardous waste was. That only comes into play with like that amendment to the Solid Waste Act. And once you have it defined, once you have the material defined, obviously it's become much more expensive to dispose of what now is considered hazardous waste. And rather than paying those much, much higher prices, I mean, I'm saying we're talking about like a change of, let's say for incinerating a ton of hazardous waste prior would cost something around $50, and then it could go up to $200, or for landfilling, even like $1,000. So there are really, really significant differences in terms of costs. At the same time, you have a much greater awareness of people about waste. I mean, you said it in your opening, waste. Currently, it's more climate change that we talk about. But the 1980s, that really was the environmental activist era focused on pollution, focused on contamination, focused on waste, focused on incineration. So it really was a topic on the forefront. And more communities were against building waste incinerators in their midst or living close to a waste dump, to a waste disposal site. And so even in a country as spacious as the United States, they are actually running out of space where to put the waste. So these two things together are push factors that more and more waste traders consider it a viable and legal alternative to start exporting their waste to other countries. Because that is something that is really, really important if you look at the waste trade from a global perspective. Not every country has the same regulations as the United States. So 1980, RCRA in place, the United States has a pretty clear and pretty strict definition of what hazardous waste is, how it's supposed to be dealt with. But many, many other countries around the world, actually most other countries around the world, do not. And hence, the same material that's classified in the US as hazardous waste can easily and legally be disposed of as municipal solid waste, as bricks building material, as fertilizer or any other usage you can actually think of in another country. And that obviously kind of reduces the costs immensely and makes it really a viable option. Yes.
Could you say more about that? I mean, so you had noted that in the early period of exporting hazardous waste, much of it went to Mexico and especially Canada. But the Cayenne Sea folks look instead to the Caribbean. They first look to the Bahamas and then Haiti. And you say, you know, you describe the Greater Caribbean kind of evocatively as a place where U.S. influence was discernible largely in the form of waste. What do you mean by that? And how did that come to be?
Yeah. So in the 1980s, obviously, like, if you look at the like the land routes, Canada and Mexico are so close. So most of U.S. waste that gets exported actually gets exported to Canada and Mexico, just because that's the countries the United States shares kind of like the longest borders with. But increasingly, waste traders also started looking into the Greater Caribbean. So that's kind of like the Caribbean islands, but also kind of like Central America and bits and pieces of kind of like Northern Latin America. And that was because there were already kind of pre-established trading connections and also kind of pre-established relationships of contamination. And that's what I meant here. And here I go back. For instance, long before the waste ships from the U.S. started to arrive in the Caribbean or in the Greater Caribbean, that region has already been targeted from the U.S. side as one of an environmental resource to support and sustain U.S. lifestyle. It starts with, let's think about 1920s, 1930s, and kind of the buildup of the empire of El Pulpo, United Fruit, so then the Kraken, and kind of all the plantations on the different islands and also kind of on the different stretches of Latin America. So already here we have the exploitation of that environment, of that nature, to support U.S. consumers and U.S. markets. And in that connection, obviously, we already have also like the export and the use of pesticides. We have like deforestation to support the plantations. We have the use of pesticides. So already, before the waste ships come, lots of environmental pollution in this region is happening in connection to sustaining U.S. markets and feeding U.S. consumers.
And so one would think that this plan probably would have worked, that we could just dump the ash, you know, pay, make a deal and dump the ash in one of these nations. But it doesn't work. And you do a really nice job of tracing changes to the social and economic context in the region to understand why it doesn't work. But can you give us a preview of that? Why didn't it work?
So quite similarly to why communities in the U.S. no longer wanted to have waste disposal sites close to them, that also happens in the Greater Caribbean, and then later also on the African continent, where the Cayenne Sea moves to next. What we see happening is a correlation on the one hand between also growing environmental awareness that is simultaneously also nourished through environmental activist groups like Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth from the US that reach out and warn the Greater Caribbean nations about what's going on. And that is coupled, or that environmentalism can actually take off, because at the time we also see a greater political and economic estrangement between many of the countries in the Greater Caribbean and the United States. I mean, most noteworthy there is a case of Panama, where they have the Noriega government that really gets in this fight with the US of violent protests against US presence in Panama, with kind of the storming of the US embassy, and eventually kind of the CIA moving into the country and trying to kind of replace Noriega. So in that context, it becomes fashionable to question US presence and to question kind of the environmental exploitation of their countries. So they're no longer, US traders are no longer just seen as harbingers of development and progress, but rather as those destroying the livelihoods of people. And so what we see, in, for instance, in the case of Panama, it's like directly linked to an anti-Americanism that's rising at the time. In the case of Haiti, it's very interesting that like the protest against the ash that the KNC ends up abandoning, for lack of a better word, in Gonaives, that happens right after the ousting of the dictatorship of Baby Doc. So this is kind of as part of the first steps in practicing democracy. Environmentalism gets coupled to democratic practice, to neighborhood committees. And that really kind of then also pushes that kind of environmentalism that is very outspoken, very vocal against the waste exports from the US to the greater Caribbean.
And alongside this resistance from populations in citizens of Caribbean nations, there was substantial concern within the federal government of the United States about U.S. firms and U.S. cities exporting hazardous waste abroad. More concern than I would have expected there to be, I'll be honest. And voices in both parties to some extent. And so what contributed to the, why were U.S. policymakers worried about this? And then how did that lead to some, how did that inform policymaking?
Yeah, that is also kind of one of the surprises I had. I was fascinated to see Mike Signer, for instance, discuss like as head of the powerful committee of government operations, like really rally against the exports of hazardous waste. I think their concern was not necessarily one about the environment in the greater Caribbean, but their concern was one of foreign policy and the image of the United States in the world at large. And here we do see kind of like a split in positions in the government. For instance, the US EPA is very much siding as one could say is almost tradition in the 1980s, the US EPA siding with companies with more like the economic sector than with environmental protection. And they say, well, if we are actually like making export rules stricter, we're limiting the chances of US companies to be successful abroad. So that is their main concern. They need to protect business people and their exports, which is kind of funny because it's the Environmental Protection Agency that they say we actually need to protect businesses as they're doing business abroad. Yeah, probably. Yeah. But there is a bipartisan consensus outside the EPA that then is like really pushing through a change in governance on those exports that is very worried about U.S. standing. I mean, they're discussing we cannot export a U.S. Love Canal. I think that really is kind of the memory that they have in their minds and the fear that they have in their minds that kind of if they end up exporting something like a Love Canal to other countries, that this is absolutely and fundamentally going to damage the U.S. image in the world, coming in a crucial time period at the end of the Cold War, where that image is key for the negotiations.
Life is a highway. and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is a story that isn't just shaped by the politics of international development or international relations. It's also very much shaped by the politics of science. And so meanwhile, as the KNC is chugging about the Atlantic shopping for a port, there's all this debate about how dangerous this stuff is that it has on board, as it's being described as dangerous by policymakers and activists. You memorably refer to it's slowed here as the most tested and most contested ash on the planet. Why was there so much uncertainty about the threat that was posed by this ash, and by what means did stakeholders attempt to combat that uncertainty?
So I think that question actually goes deep with or resonates with environmental historians working on any contamination cases. We're always shooting at a moving target and establish some sort of causality between, like, you have a contaminant here and then you have the damage here. There's a direct correlation. I mean, that's not how the whole field of the history of pollution and contamination works. But in that case, it is particularly noteworthy how often that particular heap of ash gets tested and contested again. And what we see happening here, I mean, earlier on when you asked me about the composition of the ash, I said, well, there's a short scientific answer, and then there's a longer answer, which is probably the one I'm going to give you now. What we have in the background, obviously, is that there is this discussion and debate in the United States among scientists about incinerator ash, and then connected to that, a discussion within the US EPA if incinerator ash should be part of RCRA as hazardous waste, or if it should be exempt from hazardous waste regulation. So the US itself is unsure, is this hazardous waste, is this not hazardous waste? So that is one point to the puzzle piece. Another point that we need to understand is that the 1980s is also a time when scientists are now able to do much, much finer tests. So they're able to measure toxicants and parts per trillion. And that is something that not every laboratory can do, and certainly not a laboratory in the Greater Caribbean. So the Caribbean nations, the Greater Caribbean nations, and also the African nations, they need to rely on the test results that the exporters give them. Or they need to, like, send it to another laboratory somewhere in another European country. And that brings up the issue of trust. They need to trust that what the traders say is in the ash or is in the waste actually really is in it. And here is where the breach of trust starts. Because the discussion was built around the EPA and also the laboratories just considering the ash, but not considering where it was supposed to be dumped. So it does make a significant difference if you say, well, this is incinerator ash, and it can be safely put in a sealed landfill. Right, a sanitary landfill that is sealed on the bottom and it's sealed on the top. So here it actually is quite safe to put it. But it's a very, very different story if you take that same ash and just put it as fill in a wetland where there's no sealed container around it, where dioxins and furans and also PCBs heavy metals can just kind of like seep in the ground and in the groundwater, contaminate the soil, the water, and also kind of like the air if the wind takes it up. But tests weren't considering this context. The party that considered that kind of context were the environmental activists. And they were sowing the doubts about the truthfulness of the accounts that the traders gave the nations in the Greater Caribbean. And so what we see happening over the course of 1988, largely, is that the story just takes off in two opposite directions. And science is absolutely discredited, like importing nations in the Greater Caribbean or almost from all over the global south have completely lost trust in what U.S. laboratories, the U.S. EPA even, tells them about like the different cargoes on the waste ships. Because they start seeing that the EPA does not consider that the context of where the ash or any waste ends up is different. And they also start seeing that communities in the U.S. do not want it. So there's kind of like this ping pong effect. So why should we in Panama or on the Bahamas, why should we accept a cargo that U.S. communities do not want? And it's very, very interesting how kind of to see the end point of that really kind of breaking apart of any kind of scientific objectivity when we go to one of the Greenpeace accounts. So Greenpeace, in January 1988, a team of Greenpeace members, they actually come to Haiti to inform the people about like the composition of the ash, to work together with them to test the ash again, to see where it's being stored. And they hold a press conference. And when I was interviewing one of the Greenpeace activists there, he said he was so surprised to see how in the minds of people, the life of the waste, the life of the ash had taken on something completely different. And then he says, for all what it's worth, it could have been radioactive. We actually had to downplay the dangers that were connected with that ash because they were afraid that there were climate riots about to break out because people were just not listening anymore to anything. For them, like toxic waste was simultaneously or was synonymous to nuclear waste. And in that moment, you could have come with any kind of tests. Nobody would believe you anymore. And it's very interesting from a scientific perspective how the waste traders are attempting to kind of to stop that that distrust, and so they fall back on what I think is kind of the simplest test we have in science, but also probably one of the most powerful. They stand there and they eat the ash. So he comes to Haiti and he's like really like eating the stuff and offering his own body, saying, listen, I don't fall dead from it. Despite that he has no idea about kind of like the differences in chronic and acute poisoning. But on that end it's really, really interesting.
And it's really this global resistance that's led by Greenpeace, but also by local populations and their understandings of the threat posed by the ash that really cements the legacy of the Cayenne Sea. As you note many times, you know, it's the load itself is not the most dangerous hazardous waste that has been trucked around the world. It's not that much. 15,000 tons of ash is not a lot of ash as ash goes, I learned in your book. but it was really all the attention that was heaped on it and the political ramifications of that. And so could you spin out a bit about those ramifications? What happened? How did we get to, for instance, the Basel conventions?
Yeah. So as you quite rightly pointed out, I mean, in kind of the larger scheme of the global waste economy, the KNC actually isn't the most dangerous ship that's out there among the toxic ships that we have. But what is super interesting is how it takes on a life of its own. And because, I mean, the story is one of the ship changing names, ship changing owners, from the KNC to the Felicia, to the Palacano, to the San Antonio, it is a game of cat and mouse. And it makes for such a good story for environmentalists that we learn a lot about kind of successful environmental campaigning. You need a good story. And the KNC was such a good story that you could, no matter what actually was happening about that one particular ship, you could still tease out the fundamental themes and topics what the global waste trade actually stood for. And this is what kind of an alliance of environmental justice activists did. And so here, obviously, we have kind of Greenpeace on the forefront with their global waste campaign, but they were very clever in teaming up with local environmentalist groups from Haiti, from Panama, from around Africa. And they were really, really successful in teaming up with the Organization of African Unity at the time. And so in that alliance, they were so strong and powerful to like push a process come to an end point, and the end point is the Basel Convention on the transboundary movement of hazardous waste and their disposal that had been cooking for almost a decade. It's not that this KNC like single-handedly pushed through the Basel Convention, but it is the kind of scandal, it is the kind of campaigning one needed to bring that process to a successful conclusion.
Yeah, and I have to note, it is such a good story, especially as told by you, and I can't do justice to it. I can't ask questions that allow us to kind of trap the narrative, so you're going to have to buy the book. But it's also, as you're saying, it's a very politically useful story for opponents of the global waste trade. And yet you conclude that the political utility of it really, in your words, kind of vanished completely in the 90s and the early parts of the 21st century. Why? What thwarted the potential that it had?
Yeah, so this for me, if you ask me, like, what is kind of one of the most important chapters of this book, I think the story that I tell in my final chapter on what happens after the Basel Convention, to me, is almost the most important one, because it puts that success story of the Basel Convention in perspective and says also a lot about kind of UN conventions and what happens to them once they are in place. I mean, something that we see now with kind of the Paris Agreement. Nations can agree on a lot of things, but it's the question of putting this agreement into practice. And here we also see kind of the Basel Convention really, really stalling. Because two things happen at the same time. You have or actually three things happening. You have the Basel Convention, right, implemented at a time when youth elections are just passed. And so this momentum where, I mean, prior to Basel, we had Bush Senior versus Dukakis, and like both are actually like running on an environmental ticket. So out of a sudden, you have this presidential race where environmental issues are on the forefront. And obviously, both are standing there and saying, we support the Basel Convention. We support like tighter waste legislations nationally and internationally. Well, we're past this convention or we're past this election. And now youth legislators are faced with a conundrum that is with any UN convention, it's a matter of, are you first changing federal legislation and then accepting or and then joining the UN convention? Or are you joining the UN convention and hence let the United Nations regulations actually override your own national legislations? And that is quite difficult given that environmental legislations in the US are not just an issue of the national level, but there are so many federal states that are also part of it. So what would happen if the US joined the US Basel Convention? It would actually allow an international governance body to override and to overwrite environmental legislations of all its federal states. And I mean, if you listen carefully, I said if it were to join, so that the end point of the story is that neither the United States nor Haiti, for that matter, did join the Basel Convention. So we have a United Nations governance tool in place where like one of the most important, if not the most important player when it comes to the production of hazardous waste is not part of the agreement. So that is one of the unresolved conundrums that we have. Another one is in the Basel Convention itself, because the Basel Convention, although it's followed by the Stockholm Convention and the Rotterdam Convention, so there are more to follow in the 90s and the 2000s, it still has a loophole that's, I would say, as large as, I don't know. You could drive a ship through it, absolutely. And that is that disposal is not permitted, but recycling is. And so the same schemes can actually continue. They just get a different headline. And then there is waste exports still happening just under the premise of recycling. And that's what we see now with like e-waste. That's what we see with plastics, that the ships just continue to go abroad, saying they bring those waste objects or waste products for recycling to the other countries. And also, like, in the way it's implemented, the Basel Convention very much happens still on a philosophical agreement on what waste and hazardous waste is, which means that it still allows for a lot of difference between the nations or the members of that convention in terms of what they consider to be hazardous waste, where they put thresholds, what kind of methods they allow to be used for certain materials to be disposed of, what they consider as recycling, what they consider as second-hand material. And since there is only a philosophical agreement on a lot of these terms, it's actually a very weak convention. And the last thing that happens, just to add to this, is the bittersweet taste of success is that once you have such a regulation in place, it becomes really hard for environmental campaigning to target something. And that's also what we see now with the climate accords. Like, it's easier to rally against a villain, but once you have something like the Paris Climate Accords in place, you need to go down to the nitty-gritties of the details. And that's also something that Greenpeace headquarters realized. And unfortunately, I would say now, as the historian looking at that story, they decided that Basel was enough of a success and didn't push further or didn't expand their campaign, as some of the campaigners actually wanted, to not only look at the end product of the global commodity chain, to not just look at the export of waste, but also to look at the relocation of dirty industries, the way like primary resources are being extracted. But Greenpeace shifted in its campaigning rather again towards the dramatic images that we see with like the oil platforms and that.
Yeah, one thing that kept nagging at me while I was reading, and you explicitly call attention to this in your conclusion, was that when all of this national attention was being was tracking the Cayenne Sea, and there was all this talk about solid waste in the 80s, it was just striking how little discussion there was about the production of the stuff that ended up being there. There's lots of talk about the consumption of it, lots of talk about the disposal of it, certainly, but very little talk about the actual upstream, how it all began. And I wonder why you think that was, and how much better do you think we're doing today at kind of attending to the entire life cycle of our stuff?
So I'm gonna start with your second question, because it's something that actually does give me hope that we're doing better today than we were in the 1980s. We're actually like recycling rates up, reusing rates up, and reducing waste is more of a topic than it was in the 1980s. Having said that, we're still facing, I mean, the level of waste is still rising. So reduction and reuse and recycle really hasn't had the effect that environmentalists would have hoped it does, although it's more of a topic, it's more of a practice. So there's hope that we can actually like just scale it up. I think the 1980s just wasn't a good time to think about like reducing waste, given that many industrial countries had just come, particularly the United States, had just come out of an economic recession. It's Reaganomics, it's like more about like creating more growth and more expansion. It's also still in this like post-war era of consumption, almost of overconsumption, as part of a middle class identity. And so topics like you actually need to reduce your consumption, you need to buy less, just weren't something that would sit well with kind of society at large. And that comes later. It starts in the 2000s. Particularly with kind of reducing and reusing. Recycling to some degree is there in the 1980s. I feel like the society in that particular moment just wasn't ready yet to act on it.
I'd love to hear a little bit about how you put the book together and the research. One of the things that I haven't allowed you to do justice to at all here is how prominent and interesting the corporate and the firm, the corporations and the firms are that are commissioning and charting and also, you know, funding and also the laborers working on the ship itself, how much they are in the book and how exciting it is that they are as characters. Stories about corporations and business firms are always, you know, tough research challenges. And I wonder how you kind of stitch that story together. What kind of documents were, you know, do you wish maybe you wish you had available to you that weren't, you know, is that what parts of the story are still kind of the murkiest, even after all of your work here?
So, to be honest, like 2 years into the story, I almost abandoned it completely because I felt like I'm not finding the right entry point to the global waste economy. And part of it is that so many of the waste traders, they've disappeared. They've not kept company records or a company archive. They've gone broke. Also, like on the importing side, oftentimes it's super difficult to figure out who the importer was. You just have a name in a town or a city where the importer came from. And so it was so hard to stitch that together from like from the inside perspective of like the economic deal that's going on. And I was lucky that it was just at that moment when I felt like I'm running against dead ends that I changed my approach and I started doing oral history interviews. I'm like, okay, I'm not getting anywhere with the companies. So let's start talking to people. And that's when I started talking to journalists who had chronicled some of the waste deals, not only the KNC, but also the Mibro, the Bark, the Bunya, the Carenbi, like lots of those ships. And I started talking to some of the activists from the Times, some of the actors in Philadelphia. And that's when the story started coming to life to me through their memories, also through the materials that they had still like, sitting in their basement on what they had collected about it. And step by step, it was really going back to the people that opened doors that I hadn't seen earlier on. And they would then kind of usher me towards sources or what is really, really key in the story of the KNC are the court cases. I mean, eventually, like the two traders, the two US representatives connected to the case, they get convicted. And so there's a humongous paper trail actually sitting in like the National Archives in Philadelphia because of the court cases that we have. And that is what opens up the story to you or to me. And then like falling down that path, one of the most beautiful collections that I encountered, I'm just like, encouraging everyone with an interest in Caribbean history to look at that source. Duke University Libraries has a donation from Radio Haiti Inter. So Radio Haiti was a communications channel, a radio station that was very much helping democracy take hold in Haiti. And they were following what happened around the KNC from beginning to end. And so all these papers, like all the radio clips are donated or have been donated to Duke University. And so that was just a treasure trove to uncover that story or to tell a story, not only from a US perspective, but also from like the importer perspective, from the perspective of the Haitians and from like the environmental activists on the ground and the locals on the ground. It was a little tricky to hear into and to translate Haitian Creole. But it's just such a wonderful, wonderful resource.
That's so cool. The book is such an achievement, and I know readers are going to love it. And it's going to make my next question sound greedy, but I wonder if you have any, before I let you go, if you have any current or future projects you're willing to give us a sneak preview of.
Yeah. So the toxic ship really brought me in a way to I felt just with like my first book on the wiring of the world, I felt like I had come to a dead end and I needed to approach my intellectual puzzle from a different angle. And that also, interestingly, has happened again as I had finished A Toxic Ship. And the conundrum that stayed with me and that I'm now engaging with under the concept of toxic commons is the binaries that we have. So the toxic ship kind of left me wondering about, so how do we actually live with a permanently polluted planet. So in the story, there's all this discussion and talk about cleanup, about remediation, about recycling. But as you hinted at, we need to go, first of all, we need to go to the beginning of the commodity chain, but then we also need to come to terms with the question that we cannot go back to a point where we actually live on a pristine and clean planet. There will always be contamination. And even if you do remediation, the contaminated soil, it also has to go somewhere. And so with toxic commons, I'm grappling with the questions of how do we live well with an increasingly contaminated planet where it's actually a play on words with toxic commons, how our common pool resources become increasingly toxic, increasingly contaminated. And at the same time, it becomes increasingly common for us to be exposed to that contamination, albeit to very unequal degrees. And so the question that puzzles me is, how do we live with it? And how do we live with it in a way that it's not historically marked sacrifice zones? How do we live with it that it's not marginalized people, that this increasingly contaminated planet is not a reproduction of global inequality, of geographies, of racism yet again? I do not have an answer to it yet, but I feel what it led me to is to ask different questions, not about remediation, but more about what does it mean to be with that, to live with it.
What a project. That's something for us to really be excited to look forward to in the future. Here in the present, this book, again, is The Toxic Ship, The Voyage of the Cayenne Sea and the Global Waste Trade. It comes out today from University of Washington Press. Its author is, and my guest has been, Dr. Simone Mueller. Simone, thank you so much for your time and for this book.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me about it. It's been a joy and a pleasure.